You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Last week, media company Condé Nast announced a major round of layoffs at Pitchfork, an online music publication known for covering alternative and independent music. They also announced that Pitchfork is being folded into the legacy men's magazine GQ. The news created a big stir online with music lovers lamenting what they see as the end of an era for Pitchfork and its unique contributions to the music world. And the Pitchfork GQ merger is one example in a bigger trend of corporate restructuring in media, which often results in arts and culture coverage getting reduced or gotten rid of. Our next guest joined the chorus of voices saying goodbye to Pitchfork as we know it, and she says that this moment isn't just significant for loyal readers of that magazine, it's a turning point in music journalism more broadly. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read music reviews? Do you have a favorite music critic or music magazine or website? Has a site like NPR or Pitchfork ever helped you discover new music? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ann Powers is NPR Music's critic and correspondent. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Now, some people listening right now are intimately familiar with Pitchfork. Others, maybe not so much. For that last group, can you talk a little bit about what Pitchfork is, was, and why it's such a big deal in music journalism?
Sure. Pitchfork is a web zine or web publication that was founded by Ryan Schreiber, Midwesterner, record store clerk, in his basement. And oh gosh, we're live radio. I think it was 2006. He was a record store clerk and he had this idea to create a website devoted to music reviews. Over several years, Pitchfork became known as sort of like the indie Bible, specifically for indie rock releases. Ryan Schreiber invented this, well, he didn't really invent it because there's been lots of grading systems, you know, for music publications, whether it was Rolling Stone with their stars or the great Robert Christgau with his consumer guide, he would give letter grades. But Pitchfork has a numerical system and it's down to the decimal point. So that caused a lot of controversy and joy and sorrow in the music world as certain records were, you know, anointed, certain artists were anointed, like Radiohead receiving a 10 for their album Kid A, and others like the Australian band Jet receiving a 0.0. So that helped make Pitchfork this incredibly influential publication in the music world. For about the past 8 or 9 years, however, Pitchfork has become a different kind of publication. They expanded to also include interviews, features, news, and also under new editorial leadership became much more diverse. The staff was very diverse, and what they covered ranged from, you know, electronic experimental music to Afrobeats to Americana music to straight up pop alongside indie rock. So in many different corners of the music world were rocked when Condé Nast, who has owned Pitchfork since 2015, decided to absorb it into the men's magazine GQ, formerly known as Gentleman's Quarterly, and lay off many of the top staff members, including the editor-in-chief, Pooja Patel. And that's who Pitchfork is.
The journalism industry is difficult in lots of different places. This is a huge change at Pitchfork. The brand will still exist, but based on what you're seeing, rolling it into GQ, laying off a key staff like this, do you expect Pitchfork to play anything like the role it has in the past?
Well, I have to say, they're still publishing beautiful reviews. Even the day I think that the announcement happened, the writer Jen Pelly published a review of the new Slater Kinney record by her, and it was just a beautiful piece of writing. So the review section, the editor Jeremy Larson is trying to keep it intact, but the staff has been reduced to, I think, like 4 people. And, you know, if all that's surviving is reviews, it just changes the whole nature of what Pitchfork is. And we still, you know, it remains to be seen what happens. I'll tell you, Tyler, I've been through this many times. I've worked in the industry for more than 30 years at places like the LA Times, the Village Voice, New York Times. And I have seen how, you know, after a wave of layoffs, it just, you know, you're trying to like, walk a skeleton down the street, essentially. So that's what we fear, that Pitchfork just won't be what it was.
Ann Powers is with us from NPR Music, looking at music journalism, music criticism, and a big change in that world with Pitchfork being cut way, way back, rolled into another label. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Specifically, are you or have you ever been a reader of Pitchfork? Or more generally, where do you go for music reviews, music criticism? Do you see value in it? Is there something you used to read, but it's not the same anymore? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, why we have music journalism and music criticism. And one answer is, you know, utility and discovery of music. And we could talk about that in a bit. But you go a little deeper than that. You see value in taking time to engage with music in these ways. Sell us a little bit on the value of having music reviews in Pitchfork or NPR or elsewhere.
Well, yeah. And in my sat down to write about what was going on at Pitchfork, there had already been, and there continues to be, you know, a wave of sort of elegies and Jeremiads about what's happened. And you know, this goes beyond this one publication, although certainly Pitchfork is so central, it's very upsetting. But there's been just an unfathomable number of layoffs in music, in journalism in general, and in arts journalism in particular, in the past few years, really. So what, you know, people were writing about how it's going to hurt the music industry. It's going to be so hard for everyone but the top 1%, like the Taylor Swifts and Beyoncés of the world, to get coverage. Also about, you know, the fact that Pitchfork had become a very diverse magazine in every way, that was suffered a blow because of what happened. But for me, I wanted to talk about kind of the glorious uselessness, as I called it, of music writing. You know, I think we don't make enough room in our lives for pleasure, for that space to sort of contemplate and enjoy language, enjoy just the pleasure of listening to music. And for me as a music writer, that's at the center of what I do, is really just trying to have an encounter with a work and share my own enthusiasm and excitement and insights with readers. And I feel in our culture in general, we don't make enough space for that, as we're all out there on the hustle. You know, we're always trying to better ourselves and prove our worth to the world. So that's what I think is really lost when the art of criticism is undervalued.
I'm going to quote you at you, summing up what you just said. You wrote at NPR.
I love it. Thank you.
you wrote at NPR, great music writing messes with productivity by creating a space to slow down and really immerse in someone else's creative work, to really listen. That really spoke to me, because I'm somebody, I often used to, my inactivity would be, I'm going to listen to music now. And yes, Now I'm going to listen to music while I'm cooking or doing something else right now.
Right.
How do we re-engage, whether we're doing it through music journalism or just at home on our own? How do we re-engage in that way? Because I think I'm not the only one who has that story.
That's a great question. And I think there's probably two kind of answers that contradict each other. One, you know, and many people talk about this, is make a space where you're not on five screens at once. You know, turn off your social media, maybe, you know, put on a vinyl record. Vinyl has enjoyed a huge resurgence in the past decade because people are trying to create that space. And yeah, they're also, it's a fetish object, you know, a vinyl record. But we have, you and I probably both have memories of like sitting in your room and like holding a record and reading the lyrics. You know, I remember when I first got Bruce Springsteen's album Born to Run, and you know, reading along the lyrics that were printed, I think, on the gatefold, and just thinking about what these songs meant. So make that kind of space. That's one answer. But then the other answer would be, you know, we are living in a new moment. And I don't want to say there's no value in things like TikTok. You know, TikTok, there's, I'm on TikTok. I don't make TikToks, but I find a lot of great artists on TikTok. So also kind of adjust your equilibrium to learn how to absorb culture in different ways. So it's a balance between those two things, I think.
Ann Powers is with us, NPR Music's critic and correspondent. And we're talking about music journalism, music criticism, and the recent layoffs at the online music site Pitchfork and its merger with the men's magazine GQ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read reviews of new albums? Did you used to, maybe, but you don't anymore? Where do you go to find new music? Where do you go to discover new stuff? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We just heard a clip there from the song Holocene by Wisconsin's own Bon Iver. We continue our talk with veteran music journalist and NPR music critic Ann Powers about big changes at the music website Pitchfork and wider trends in music journalism. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Any Pitchfork readers out there? Or have you gone to the Rolling Stone magazine over the years, or its website now, or Cream, or NME, or other, or NPR Music for that matter, to read and learn and maybe discover new music? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I know you're out there. Call it and share your stories. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. And we just heard a little Bon Iver there. And I think Pitchfork got some credit in helping publicize Bon Iver, maybe leading to their best new album for a Grammy. Can you talk about how Pitchfork played a role in, especially in the indie world, in putting new bands on the map?
Oh, yeah, definitely, Rob. I mean, an artist like Justin Vernon, Bon Iver, it's hard to think of his rise without the help of the music press, you know? I mean, first of all, how do you even alert people to this music? Second of all, to have that imprimatur, you know, that endorsement by critics you trust, it just amplifies the reach of these artists, I think. And you know, let's talk about Taylor Swift for a minute. Why not? Taylor Swift dominates our culture so much, and I'm a fan. I love Taylor Swift. You know, I wouldn't call myself a Swiftie, but I think she's very talented and gifted and really embodies this moment in a lot of ways. But Taylor Swift is one woman, one artist. And when more and more of arts writing is focused on those individuals, you know, when Gannett famously hired a Taylor Swift reporter, right? And when that's happening, when one artist dominates, or just a handful of 1% artists, as I call them, the 1% of the music world, then, you know, an artist like Justin Vernon, there's just no room for them to emerge. Pitchfork was really, you know, and even looking at the homepage right now, it's just so great that they cover everything from, you know, very obscure electronic records to Afrobeats, like I said before. But, you know, I'm looking right now and there's the Green Day record, sure, but there's also a wonderful new record by the Danish electronic artist Astrid Sand. You probably never would have heard of that record if a critic didn't recommend it to you. The algorithm probably won't lead it to you on your streaming service.
And I wonder how much search engine optimization, SEO, that people talk about drives music coverage in the press and online these days. If I put Taylor Swift in my article, that's going to drive a lot more hits than Danish electronica band that you may not have heard of.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think all of us journalists, including public radio, we feel that pressure to you know, get the views, get the listens. Everything is quantifiable now. I mean, when I worked at the New York Times back in the 90s, oftentimes dance and classical music would be on the front page of the paper because, you know, those were considered the establishment art forms. They had much smaller audiences than, say, popular music or blockbuster movies. But there was a sense, and I'm not saying better or worse, you know, as a pop critic, I hated that at the time. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm on page, you know, C12, and the dance performance is on the front page of the section. That didn't necessarily feel great, but the pendulum has swung so far in the other direction now. I actually think it's also having an effect on cultural production. I think, you know, you see a lot more of sort of the establishment arts, the fine arts. There's a lot more pop cultural references in there, you know, or collaborations or whatever. And I think that's partly because, oh, we have to sell this. We have to sell this to the audience. And that's unfortunate because I believe, you know, at time in art for art's sakes, you know, I do believe also that for maybe marginalized people, people who aren't at the center of the mainstream, we need to hear their voices too. And that's part of my job, is to alert people to that stuff you might not know about otherwise.
Talking to Ann Powers, NPR music critic and correspondent, looking at the current state of music journalism with big changes for Pitchfork, getting a lot of attention in the music world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to read music criticism, music reviews? 800-642-1234. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hey, how we doing, Rob? Thanks for taking the call. I'm going to make this real quick because my cell phone cut in and out on it. Back when I was in the industry, which was back in the mid to late 70s, we followed everything on Billboard. The radio station had a subscription, and that was kind of what we used to pick and choose our music.
Yeah, so, no, Billboard is so important. It's like a trade industry publication. And for those in the industry, it was historically essential. But it's interesting that even Billboard has entered kind of the general interest space now too, right? Like they're doing celebrity profiles and stuff. And maybe now there's Billboard Biz for those who are in the industry. But, you know, even those trade magazines are having to try to like get the clicks and not pander. That's a terrible word. I love my friends at Billboard. Don't get me wrong. But, we're all competing for that eyeball. And I think sometimes the specialized news that you would need, Pat, the specialized news you would need is much harder to access in some ways.
Pat, thanks a lot for that call. And something that struck me there was they'd read Billboard and then they, at that station, would select which songs they're playing. As I understand it, in the commercial radio world, especially with some of the more popular genres, that decision might be on a computer in another city somewhere, and you're getting kind of the same mix of stuff that everybody else is getting around the country. Fewer and fewer individual decision makers, I guess I'm saying, along the way.
Right. This is a big matter of discussion right now, is the human touch to curation, the human touch to discovery. I mean, radio, think about when, for those of us of a certain age or growing up, we loved certain DJs. And even then there was controversy about playlists becoming automated, right? And the freeform DJs of the 70s, for example, became, endangered even at that time. The algorithms are sneaky. They make you feel like you're being catered to personally, but what you ultimately get is kind of this like washed out, just monotone stream of stuff. You you don't have that left field pick. You don't have, rock and roll started with DJs like Alan Freed, saying, I'm going to take a chance. I'm going to play this artist on the radio. I'm going to possibly lose all of my listeners by doing this, And that kind of daring is what leads us into musical revolutions. And that just doesn't feel like it's happening now, at least not in the States.
And I'll start things off by saying NPR Music is a fine place to go and read great writing about music. Apart from
Thank you.
Where do you like to go? I just want to say it so you didn't have to decide whether to say yourself or not. Where do you go and to find good music writing outside of NPR?
Well, I do like independent publications like Stereo Gum, The Quietus, Consequence, which used to be called Consequence of Sound. I also, I look to my circle of music writers and scholars, so I definitely do that. I will say, I at first when streaming came to us all, I really enjoyed using streaming services as libraries. I think the way the interface is working on services like Spotify now, it encourages passivity in a way that I don't like as much, So I think that's a challenge. I wrestle with those platforms. I mentioned I like TikTok, but I'm always wrestling with TikTok. I'm always trying to find something new, and it's feeding me like the same artists over and over again, or even maybe the same clip of the same song. So I'm always wanting to engage with every possible way, but it can be a challenge. I'll also say shout out to live music. Go out in your neighborhood and go hear some music, because that's always the best way.
Yeah. Where do you suggest people go for discovery? I mean, you mentioned live music. Have you found some success in defeating the algorithm on any particular site to not keep giving you the stuff that it knows you're going to at least kind of like?
Yeah, I think it takes a kind of an active multi-step approach, right? So maybe you read a review of something that you think is interesting, or maybe your streaming platform gives you a song that you think is interesting. Well, then, you know, Google that artist, go to their website, you know, see what reviews have been written, you know, like look for live dates, you know, don't just let it wash over you, like reach out and connect with that artist. And I think that's still happening. You know, I was in New Orleans this past weekend and I went to see a young folk singer named Odie Lee. And she doesn't even have, I think she has an EP out. She had had a viral TikTok success with a song called Crop Circles. And that kind of sucked me in. But then I started reading about her. I started, you know, like seeking out her music and listening to it, you know, not just a clip of it on TikTok or whatever. And seeing her live, I was so enraptured because she has this really devoted audience of people who know every single word. And she's not famous. She's not in the 1%. But that's when I get excited, when I see people humanly connecting with an artist and the artist connecting with their fans.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Ann Powers, NPR Music's critic and correspondent, with us for a look at Pitchfork's impact on the music industry. What might be lost is that independent online magazine faces big layoffs and restructuring, plus a wider look at music journalism and its role in general.